I'll be brief in my introductions at his request and also to give us more time for a conversation as well. He holds a PhD in history from the University of Maryland, and shortly thereafter began his journey in politics by working in the Wisconsin State Senate in the office of the Senate Majority Leader. After that, he became a professor of history at Tulane and then to the University of South Carolina, from which he joined us 2 years ago now, I think, as Dean of Arts and Sciences and professor of history here at Boston College. Dean Maney is the author of biographies of Robert La Follette and, to our point today, Franklin Roosevelt, and is currently researching a book on the Clinton presidency as well. His topic today is the Roosevelt legacy, how FDR shaped the modern presidency.
I would just say that we mentioned the Clinton presidency. The first time I was introduced as somebody who was researching a book on the Clinton presidency, I was in the reddest of the red states, South Carolina, at a Rotary Club. And I was actually there to be talking about Roosevelt, but I was introduced as a Clinton biographer, and people started to boo. And this is before I said a word. And I said, well, I haven't even started this book. So I appreciate your tolerant reception. For over 60 years, Franklin Roosevelt has been the model of the modern presidency, a model aspired to by all of his successors, Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives. Now, true enough, in this campaign, he has been temporarily upstaged, first by John F. Kennedy when Obama was riding high, and I think more recently by Teddy Roosevelt with McCain's resurgence. But mark my words, once the election is over, Roosevelt will again return to the throne, and once again we will be using Roosevelt's first 100 days as a yardstick to measure the performance of the new president. If they don't achieve Rooseveltian feats during those 100 days, we will declare them failures. It's not surprising that Democrats would talk about their fabled leader as much as possible. But what is surprising is that these days, Republicans talk about Roosevelt just maybe even more than Democrats do. In fact, in the recent convention, if you watch the Republican convention, there were several, Roosevelt's name was invoked a couple of times, and it drew a warm applause. Vice President Cheney likes to boast that he and Franklin Roosevelt share the same birthday, January 30th. Well, when we get to the point where probably the most controversial president in all of our history, the best loved and most hated president, becomes the kind of the all-purpose hero of Republicans as well as Democrats, liberals and conservatives, maybe it's time to step back and ask some hard questions about Roosevelt's place in our collective imaginations. How did he, this controversial and divisive president, how did he become an all-purpose role model? Does he deserve that status? Is it wise or even possible for his successors to try to emulate his success? Some of you may remember that Roosevelt was not always embraced by everyone. There was a time when loyal partisan Republicans could hardly bring themselves to pronounce his name, and it was done, if they could at all, it was done in a sputtering rage. He was that man to many. The real turning point came in the 1980s with the Reagan administration. President Reagan, well, when he was running for office, and then during the 1980s, Reagan, who grew up as a loyal Democrat, invoked Roosevelt's name frequently, while at the same time saying unkind things about Roosevelt's New Deal. At first, it was kind of difficult for Republicans to take this in. I mean, many of them had grown up, most Republicans had grown up thinking that Roosevelt was the devil, the one who had brought the welfare state at home and sold out Eastern Europe to the Russians abroad. One Republican who had a hard time with this new sort of party, emerging party line, was the wife of Reagan's vice president, Barbara Bush. And one time she was asked, well, what are her thoughts about Eleanor Roosevelt? And Barbara Bush said, you may recall, she said that she had, when she was growing up, her mother had taught her that if she couldn't say something nice about a person, she shouldn't say anything at all. So she didn't say anything at all. Finally, however, Republicans caught on until in 1994, Newt Gingrich became the first Republican speaker in some 40 years. And in his, I guess what do you call his inaugural address as speaker, he proclaimed Franklin Roosevelt the greatest political leader of the 20th century. And when you think of it, Reagan's embrace of Roosevelt was pretty shrewd. After all, Reagan won election and was reelected in part because of the votes of Democrats. But before these people had been Reagan Democrats, they had been Roosevelt Democrats, or likely the sons and daughters of Roosevelt Democrats. And so Reagan understood that it didn't make a whole lot of sense to try and get these people votes and at the same time say they were stupid to have liked Franklin Roosevelt. Their Democrats have caught on, I think, in recent years. They made a lot about Reagan in an attempt to get the Reagan Democrats back. They made a lot about Reagan, I don't remember when he died. And then more recently, Obama caused kind of a stir when he said that Reagan had actually had a more significant presidency than Bill Clinton. But there was a sort of a shrewdness to Obama's remarks. Okay, well, it's not surprising that presidents would embrace Roosevelt. I mean, don't get me wrong, Roosevelt was a great president. I mean, not once, but twice. He was the man of the hour who came to the rescue of the country, first in the depths of the Great Depression. His buoyant optimism and life-affirming personality just sort of infused the country, a dispirited country, with hope. And then during a second time of great peril, the Second World War, he presided over the most successful military operation in American history. He left important legacies and enlarged government, more powerful government, really the modern presidency in many of its forms, and a strong political coalition. Reputation, what of his successors wouldn't envy Roosevelt's reputation? Since his death, historians have put him on a short list with Washington and Lincoln as one of the great presidents in American history. And even there's kind of lingering suspicions about that, about Pearl Harbor or Yalta have failed to diminish Roosevelt's reputation. Most historians have long since put to rest the notion that Roosevelt knew in advance about the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, or that he gave over Eastern Europe on a silver platter to Stalin. I think historians take much more seriously Roosevelt's sort of shameful role in Japanese internment, but even that has not seriously blemished his record. Roosevelt dominated another attraction. Roosevelt not only dominated politics, but he dominated American popular culture to an extent that is just simply unimaginable today. And this is something actually that has gotten me interested. It caught my attention since I wrote the book, and something that I'm exploring in a couple of different ways now. I mean, he was everywhere. He was on the radio, certainly, but everywhere else. For example, in the course of my research, I have found that there was more commercial music written about Roosevelt than any other president in history. There were symphonies, dance music, blues, hillbilly, what we would now call country music. Irving Berlin wrote a song about Franklin Roosevelt. Cole Porter did as well. George M. Cohen portrayed Roosevelt in the Rodgers and Hart musical on Broadway called I'd Rather Be Right. And then a decade later, Jimmy Cagney, in an Academy Award winning turn, portrayed George M. Cohen portraying Franklin Roosevelt. Undoubtedly, the most popular song written about Roosevelt was not Happy Days Are Here Again, but one you probably don't know about, but was one of the most popular songs in the late 30s and 40s, and it was called Franklin D. Roosevelt Jones. Have any of you ever heard about it? It was written by Harold Rome, who was a Yale-educated architect turned songwriter, and it was about the practice of primarily African-American families naming their offspring after Roosevelt. And I found that among the people who had hit recordings of this were Ella Fitzgerald, the Mills Brothers, Cab Calloway, Glenn Miller Orchestra, Judy Garland. In the late 1930s, early 40s, Judy Garland was better known for Franklin D. Roosevelt Jones than she was for Over the Rainbow. And the most famous rendition for Judy Garland was in the film Babes on Broadway. If you've ever seen that. This is a little sort of a long sidetrack, but I just wanted to play you just a speck of that, if you would, please. Yeah, this is Ella Fitzgerald.
For the Jones family has a brand new heir. He's a joy heaven sent, and they proudly present Mr. Franklin D. Roosevelt Jones. When he grows up, he never goes straight.
Put on the next one. This is Judy Garland. Got one more. Should do the next one now. This is the Glenn Miller orchestra. That's it. Anyway, you get the idea. And can you imagine? I mean, there is no. Can you imagine? There's no president since that you could have a popular recording that wouldn't be enormously controversial. Something else I have discovered, and again, this is something with that song, and there's a lot more I could say about it, because in the Babes on Broadway version, it's done in blackface by Judy Garland, but it starts on the labor stage. I'm trying to write a history of that song, and it is I think it has a lot to say about the texture of race relations as well. The oddest version of Franklin D. Roosevelt Jones was done by Charlie and his orchestra. You know, that they were actually Nazis. Between 1939 and 1942, there were shortwave broadcasts to the United States from Berlin. And in this version of Franklin D. Roosevelt Jones, the heirs who are those who are naming their kids after Roosevelt were not African Americans, but Jews. So it's really, really sort of a scurrilous version. And I've also discovered in the course of, you know, this is my post-book research, but it's just sort of amazed me that how often Roosevelt turns up in movies, commercial movies of the time that have nothing to do with Roosevelt. Just, it's stunning. And I'm going to give you just a couple of real brief examples. The first is from a popular movie in 1933, called Footlight Parade, and it had Dick Powell and James Cagney and I can't remember, Joan Blondell, and it's a musical. It's a famous Busby Berkeley musical. And anyway, it has nothing to do with Roosevelt. I just want to show you, watch the scene. Thank you. Casey. That's the Blue Eagle of the NRA. And this movie has, again, nothing to do with that at all. That's what is so stunning. Yeah, give me just one other, indulge me, one other example of this. In, I don't know, one of my, actually, one of my favorite movies growing up is called Boys Town. Have you ever seen that? It's got Father, Catholic priest Father Flanagan, who opens this home for wayward boys in Nebraska. And Spencer Tracy, 1936, won the Academy Award for playing Father Flanagan. And here is a scene from that in which one of the kids at Boys Town is seeking some consolation from Father Flanagan, this is a kid who has a disability and wants to be, I guess, mayor of Boys Town. And anyway, watch this scene.
It's a good idea. I do it myself sometimes.
Dear, suppose I'll never have any sense.
Why, sure, Tony, you've got a lot of sense. Of course, you have to exercise it so you grow.
People will always be trying to help me. I want to do things myself.
Then why not? I'm counting on you to be the mayor of Boys Town.
No. They want a fellow who's good at football and baseball. Somebody they can cheer.
Tony, there's a true story about a man who was very ill for a long time. But he had courage, that well. People began to cheer him for a lot of things. And he became the president of the United States.
And I only want to be the mayor of Boys.
Well, that soundtrack.
I remember. Can you imagine, again, any president since Roosevelt who could appear in movies like that without a big commotion? And then the other thing to take note of is that the studio heads did not like Franklin Roosevelt. He was the enemy because they associated him with labor, with his support of the Wagner Act and the labor organization. So he was on their enemies list, and yet he still shows up in scenes like that in the movies. And I just started kind of collecting these, and I have found dozens of movies in which Roosevelt appears without, the movies have nothing to do with them. This domination notwithstanding, the real point I'm trying to get to. When one begins to think of the suitability of Roosevelt as an exemplar of the modern presidency, a couple of problems, to me anyway, come to mind. First and foremost, Roosevelt did not do a lot of the things that are attributed to him. Above all, he was not the legislative mastermind of the New Deal. I could give you any number, you open almost any textbook or book about the New Deal or about that period, and you're going to have this image of Roosevelt as legislative sort of genius front and center. Let me just give you one example. This is from a book not too long ago by Robert Carroll, one of his, I think the latest volume in his Lyndon Johnson biography. Carroll said, Roosevelt proposed and proposed and proposed again while Congress scampered in a panic to approve those proposals as fast as it could. Democrats and Republicans alike say frequently, you know, Roosevelt gave us Social Security. Or more recently, you may have heard about Roosevelt gave us the Federal National Mortgage Association. You know what that is. Fannie Mae. This is inaccurate. Roosevelt did not give us those measures. This was not a one-person operation. The New Deal was a richly collaborative process in which Roosevelt aides played a role, the so-called brain trust, interest groups, cabinet ministers, a variety of others, including members of Congress. But among the participants in the New Deal, members of Congress played the most significant role. For example, during that famous storied first 100 days, there were 15 major pieces of legislation, some of which still survive to the present time. Of those 15 pieces of legislation, only two, at most two, originated in the White House. And one of those was the Economy Act, which slashed spending for veterans benefits and government employees, probably did more harm than good by withdrawing purchasing power from the public. All of the rest of those measures originated in Congress and indeed had had a long history in Congress. In fact, the New Deal Congresses were among the very best in all of American history. There were not the sort of famous names like a Webster or Calhoun or Clay in those Congresses. And yet, in terms of their sort of high-mindedness and intelligence, creativity, the New Deal Congresses probably stack up with any Congress before or since. Among the leaders of that Congress were people like Hugo Black, who later achieved distinction on the Supreme Court, Robert La Follette Jr., about whom I have written, who was heir to Wisconsin's famous political dynasty and also the model for the tragic main character in Alan Dury's classic book about Washington, Advise and Consent. Robert F. Wagner, senator from New York, who would make any informed historian's short list of maybe the 10 best senators of all time. Bronson Cutting of New Mexico. Have any of you heard of Bronson Cutting? In the House of Representatives, Sam Rayburn, Fiorello LaGuardia, Maury Maverick, David J. Lewis from Maryland. They were the architects of the New Deal. George W. Norris, the TVA. There were a few measures that got more national or international attention than the Tennessee Valley Authority. That had actually been in the works since World War I, and the principal architect of the Tennessee Valley Authority was Norris. So to say that Franklin Roosevelt gave us these measures really just does not do justice to the record. Then there are measures that we associate with Roosevelt that he opposed. One example is the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which is now sort of a backbone of the banking system. And we think of Roosevelt, that's a key part of Roosevelt's New Deal. When Arthur Vandenberg, senator from Michigan, and Henry Stiegel, a representative from Alabama, first proposed insuring bank deposits, Roosevelt opposed it. He thought it was a bad idea. He thought it would encourage bad practices, banking practices, if you were to bail out good banks as well as bad banks. And there's some now, I think he would have something to say about what's going on today. But once it was clear that this was going to pass Congress, with or without his support, Roosevelt lent his support, and ever since he has been associated with it. In some ways, it seems to me that this is more, the real story about the New Deal is a more encouraging story. I mean, it wasn't during this time of great distress and peril. I mean, we weren't saved by one person, but actually Congress responded in very creative and helpful ways. No one, I don't think, would be more surprised at Roosevelt's reputation for as being a legislative wizard than Roosevelt himself, for he did not believe that being a legislator was the key function of the presidency. He thought that the president was to be, above all, a moral leader. You may have heard he talked about how he wanted to use, like his cousin Teddy, the presidency as a bully pulpit. And also, he thought the president should be a teacher. Now, you know, I don't want to I don't want to exaggerate this. Roosevelt was not a Calvin Coolidge type, inactive. And I mean, it helps to put him in some historical perspective. If you compare him to all presidents from Washington to Hoover, well, he's an activist president. I mean, he did play a greater role in trying to steer legislation through Congress. But if, on the other hand, you compare him to presidents from Truman, his immediate successor, to Bush, he played much less of a legislative role than many, if not most of them, certainly less than Truman and Lyndon Johnson and Kennedy and Nixon and Clinton. You know, and this is an area where sort of setting the record straight, putting Congress at or near the unfolding drama of the New Deal is more than just an academic exercise. Because this perception of Roosevelt as legislator in chief has actually shaped our history. It is now expected that every president coming into office has to have this fixed agenda and then try to get as much of it done in that first 100 days. Well, understand that not even Roosevelt had that kind of agenda, and not even Roosevelt, whom these other people are trying to emulate, had this success. In a negative way, I think it's also led to sort of an atrophying of the congressional role. I mean, not as much has been expected of Congress, and Congress has not disappointed on that part. A specific example of where I think the Roosevelt has led us astray would be involved Bill and Hillary Clinton and health reform. It's no secret that the Clintons steeped themselves in Rooseveltian lore during the 1992 presidential campaign, nor is it any secret that they modeled the health care campaign after Roosevelt's effort to get Social Security. And their notion was that just as Roosevelt had given the people Social Security, they would give the country health care, and that accounted for this kind of top-down, closed-door approach. That's not how Social Security came into being. Roosevelt played a role in it, but Social Security, elements of it, had been long worked on before Roosevelt was elected. So here's an example, I think, a specific example where this effort to be like Roosevelt led to disappointment and disillusionment with the Clintons. Okay, well, that's one problem with kind of Roosevelt as a exemplar of the modern presidency. Another one, I think, is that not only did he not do all of the things that are attributed to him, but some of the things he did do are not worthy of emulation. And I mentioned Japanese internment, and I think in general he had he was not a zealous defender of civil liberties or civil rights. I find fault with him even in his treatment of critics of his foreign policy. As you may know, between 1939, the outbreak of war in Europe, and America and Pearl Harbor, there was a fierce debate in the United States between the so-called isolationists and the interventionists. And in combating the isolationists, Roosevelt, I think, set bad precedents for his successors. For example, he impugned the motives of the so-called isolationists. He said they weren't just sort of, you know, critics of a foreign policy, but they were out-and-out supporters of Nazi Germany. He sicked the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Internal Revenue Bureau wiretapping on these critics of his foreign policy. And the truth is, they didn't deserve it. Some did. Now, this was isolationists were a mixed group. Some of them were disreputable characters. Others were naive and short-sighted. But many raised legitimate concerns about the direction of American foreign policy. Very few of them were genuine isolationists. Most of the so-called isolationists were strongly opposed to Germany and Japan, and almost all of them favored a strong national defense. But on this score, I think it is a no exaggeration to say that it's a pretty short step between Franklin Roosevelt and the way he treated critics of foreign policy, and the abuses that occurred during the Johnson and Nixon, and I would add the Bush administration during later times of war. Okay, so if Roosevelt didn't do at least some of the things that have been attributed to him, if other things are not worthy of emulation, how do you account for this lofty reputation? Well, again, longevity had something to do with it. I mean, he served longer than any president ever has, or barring repeal of the 22nd Amendment to the Constitution, ever will. And what president wouldn't want to be elected four times and be the sort of idol of the masses? I think there's a third factor, and that may be the most important of all. At the time and since, people have read into Roosevelt things that just simply didn't exist. They have projected onto Roosevelt their hopes and fears. They have attributed to Roosevelt a mastery of events that he did not have, or certainly the record does not support or suggest that he had. A mastery of events that no person could have had. This tendency to sort of read into Roosevelt became part of the popular psyche during his presidency. And it's hard to describe what I'm going to describe, but it's true. There, and give you examples of this. There were large numbers of Americans who believed that Roosevelt was actually sort of a personal part of their lives, that they had a personal connection to Roosevelt. Just during the 1930s, there were some field investigators for the federal government, and one person who visited the mill towns of North Carolina noted that in almost every house, people would have a picture of Roosevelt affixed to the mantle, often something clipped from a newspaper. And she said, the people gave the impression that FDR was at once God and their intimate friend. He knows them all by name, knows their little town and mill, their little lives and problems. He is there and will not let them down. Reported an astonished field investigator from New Orleans, people down here all seem to think they know the president personally. Well, when I was doing research for my book, I at the Roosevelt Library in Hyde Park, I actually spent most of my time, and by accident, because I chanced upon these collections, I spent most of my time reading constituent letters, letters that ordinary men and women wrote to Roosevelt. I ended up reading hundreds, thousands of these letters. And what was so striking to me was that almost all of these people believed that Roosevelt would read their letters and then respond in a personal way to them. And they would pour their hearts out. They would tell them their whole life histories. It was just, it was moving, but they were writing to him, they were thinking not that some bureaucrat's going to read this, Franklin Roosevelt's going to read this. Then there were the gifts that people sent the Roosevelts, gifts by the truckload. Jams and jellies and pies and cakes and people would spend, one person spent a couple of years making a quilt for Roosevelt. I spent an entire day reading the letters that accompanied gifts to Franklin Roosevelt. And again, they were like these regular constituent letters. People would tell how much Roosevelt had meant to them, and then tell why how much they wanted him to enjoy this gift. At the end of this day, and I read hundreds of these letters, and I took the box back up to the desk, and the person, the archivist, said, "Do you want to see more?" And I hadn't even been able to make a. And I said, "What do you mean? There are more?" And I hadn't been paying attention to the names of the letters that accompanied gifts. But what I had seen in that single day, or sort of sampled, were the letters that accompanied gifts to Franklin Roosevelt by people whose first name began with the last name began with the letter A. I also discovered in the course of my research, and I think I was probably the first person to get into this collection, this astonishing number of songs and poems that ordinary people wrote about the Roosevelts. And I'm not talking about the commercial songs. That's a later discovery. There were boxes upon boxes. I calculated to be something like 14,000 songs, maybe more, 14,000 songs that were written about the Roosevelts. And the other thing, these were not professional songwriters. These were ordinary people, many of whom were writing, who were prompted by, for the very first time, to write poetry or to write music for the Roosevelts. And often they would put new words to familiar melodies, such as it was known or thought anyway that one of Roosevelt's favorite songs is Home on the Range. So that would have new words. God Bless America, Frankie and Johnny, God Save the Queen, which became God Save the Roosevelts. The titles included the Roosevelt March, Hail the Reign of Roosevelt, the White House Waltz, Down in Warm Springs, on and on and on. And these people, most of them, wrote this not with any other reason than just to express their love of Franklin Roosevelt. Here's just a random example. George DeSay from St. Louis wrote a song simply called FDR, containing the line, "He will help me through all my strife. He will help me the rest of my life." In an accompanying letter, he wrote, "This is an opportunity I have long sought to tell you the love that is in my heart." And it's just incredible. How do you explain this? I mean, that people had this feeling that Roosevelt himself, I mean, we know that this couldn't be, that the president is too busy to sit down and read and then respond and then even to know who these people were. How do you explain this? Well, part of it is, I suppose, radio. If Roosevelt could come in to your house and talk to you in that intimate way as you and your family and friends were looking at the radio receiver, you know, and there was the sense that he was really there, you know, if he could come into your house and talk to you personally, why wouldn't he be reading your letters? And I will say, as much as that has been made about radio, I don't think enough has been made about it in terms of explaining Roosevelt's, and not only Roosevelt's, but the connection that other leaders had with people. I mean, Hitler and Stalin as well. Radio, I think, to my mind, is absolutely the most powerful medium that there has ever been for communication. It's more powerful than stage or film or television. And the key thing is because it is interactive. I mean, when people were listening to Franklin Roosevelt over the radio, they were creating their own personal Roosevelt. I mean, they were looking at that radio, and in their mind, they sort of imagined the tilt of his head, I mean, the sort of angle of his cigarette holder, the expression on his face. And there's no image, when you see somebody on television or in film or on the stage, that interactive element simply does not exist. So I think that helps explain it to some degree. But Roosevelt also did things to foster the impression that he read people's mail and dealt with it personally. Now, again, if you write the White House and you say you want an autographed picture of the president, you might get an autographed picture of the president. But most of you, unless you have better connections, and you may well have better connections than I have, you know that they have machines now that do this. I mean, they're called auto pens. And remember, several years ago, Rumsfeld got in trouble for writing the family of someone who had been killed in Iraq with this auto pen. And that's what politicians do. Well, I think I'm accurate in saying, I mean, that in the course of my research, that I don't think there was any political figure before Franklin Roosevelt who used this practice as widely or as early as he did. As early as his years in the New York State Senate, he was having people sign his name. And by the time he became president, he had three people, most of whose job was to imitate his signature on letters. And now it's commonplace, but that was one of his innovations. You know, what we're seeing here is I wouldn't call this irrational, but this is the non-rational part of American politics. And it's one of the things that I think Roosevelt has, you know, one of the things that has fascinated me and continues to fascinate me about Roosevelt. But I think it's also something about the presidency in general. There's a paradox just on that intimacy, how people feeling that they have a personal connection with Roosevelt. There's a paradox for probably never had people been, in an objective sense, had they been farther removed from the president than they were with Roosevelt. You know, there was a time when, in the 19th century, where if you had the wherewithal to get to Washington, you probably could get to see the president. Thomas Jefferson used to have visitors on a first-come, first-time basis. As late as Lincoln, Lincoln's secretary estimated that three-quarters of his time was spent talking to constituents who would sort of line up, and again, if they could get to Washington, they could line up, and you could get in to see Abraham Lincoln. Well, by the time Roosevelt is president, I mean, the possibility of somebody actually getting in to see Roosevelt was pretty remote. And yet people probably have never felt as close to a president as they have Roosevelt. Okay, well, this reading into Roosevelt was certainly a part of what happened at the time, and I think his enemies were no less immune to this, and attributing again to him a mastery of events, nefarious mastery of events that not only he, but no one could have had. But I think his biographers and historians generally have also done this, have carried this on, and have read a large amount into the Roosevelt record, at least things that I have not been able to document. Now, again, this sort of the bottom line here is to suggest that Roosevelt is not the president of legend, or wasn't the president maybe we think of, or was less than or different from the president of legend. I'm not questioning his greatness. I think in the 1930s and 1940s, Roosevelt had those qualities that were critical to the American people and to the achievement of victory over the Depression and victory again during the war. I mean, in some ways, I think Roosevelt's greatest, it was not so much what he did but didn't do that was the key to his success. I mean, he was almost like, analogy is not quite accurate to say he was a Wizard of Oz, and a historian, Arthur Schlesinger, once took me to task for comparing Roosevelt to the Wizard of Oz, but in a sense he was, in that he gave people, Congress and people generally, the confidence to do what it had always been in their power to do. And this is no insignificant talent, skill, attribute of greatness. I've gone on a long time. Let me just conclude with one thing, and that's about the perils, I guess, of questioning the Roosevelt legend. Not too long after I arrived at the University of South Carolina, one day the dean, the person who is my sort of counterpart now, came down to my office in the history department, kind of a worried look on her face, and she sat down and she said that she'd gotten sort of a letter that was disturbing, and there had been a little article about me in an alumni publication, and it had a brief summary of my book. And anyway, the alum had written this letter to the dean. Dear Dean Stewart, recently I saw in one of the university's publications a brief resume of Dr. Patrick Naney, which mentioned in brief detail his book on Franklin D. Roosevelt. This description bothered me because it demonstrated a total lack of deep research. Obviously, he did not grow up during the Depression like I did, and certainly not in the country or on a farm. apparently he did not see the recent documentary on Eleanor Roosevelt, which appeared on public television. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, you will urge that he secure a copy of that documentary and also review more carefully President Roosevelt's programs and the effect they had on this country during the Depression. I certainly am one who is well aware of his success in bringing the country out of the Depression and putting people back to work when there was no welfare or Social Security. He goes on and on. It bothers me today to see so many people rewriting history. And this is not the only occasion that I have seen this happen. This is the first letter of this nature I have written in my 76 years, and only do so because I think this young man did a great disservice to a remarkable leader. Well, one who was, why was the dean, I think she would have been disturbed if any, at the feeling of any alum, but this man was Robert E. McNair, whom the name won't mean anything probably to you, but he was the longtime governor of South Carolina, and still, when he wrote this letter, a significant figure in South Carolina, and certainly in university politics. So what I did was I called up Governor McNair, and I assured him that I was not one of the revisionists that he talked about. I had a great deal of admiration for Franklin Roosevelt, as my parents did. And I also suggested, kind of gently, I think, that he might want to read the book. So I would say the same to you. I would like to have you read it.
Fortunately, I have it right here. So thank you very much, Dean Mady.